I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers to Lawrence Track at Dragon Con, and welcome to the NSA Domestic Surveillance Panel. This has been in the news quite a bit. I'd like to start with our panelists. If you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your interest in domestic surveillance. And we'll start here.
Okay. My name's TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta. I work as a lawyer, and so obviously I have a good bit of interest in the legal aspects of the of the NSA issues and what's going on with the NSA and, well, frankly, anybody else who's reading your mail. I deal with technology law and technology clients fairly frequently, and so we deal with this stuff all the time.
I'm Randall Schwartz. I've been coming out of the EFF track for 12 years now, and my concern, of course, is that we're using the threat of terrorism to keep increasing the crank on all the things we're surveilling. And at some point, I mean, when will the war on terror actually ever be over, and or are we just going to keep cranking it up? So I'm very concerned.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Segoyan. I'm the principal technologist with the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. We are a civil liberties organization that is engaged in active litigation on all manners of government surveillance. I speak at conferences around the world about surveillance, and this is by far the most interesting and well-dressed audience that I've ever spoken before, dressed or undressed, as the case may be. I finished a PhD last year that was focused on the role that internet and phone companies play in spying on their customers for the government. When I started it 6 years ago, it seemed like a very boring issue and has suddenly become very, very interesting to many people because the government simply doesn't have the resources to spy on you directly. They need the help of other companies, so they deputize your phone and internet companies. And so I've been very busy since I started the ACLU last September, and I've been extremely busy since Edward Snowden bravely leaked documents to journalists earlier this summer. So I'm looking forward to telling you a little bit more about what the NSA is doing and maybe some of the things that we can do to stop them from intruding on our private affairs.
Hi, my name is Christina, and I am a criminal defense attorney, and so I think that my interest in how this information that's being collected is used is kind of pretty obvious, and I think that it's becoming more and more interested
in increasing number of cases, and so that's definitely my area of interest.
My name is Jeff Termenshagen. I've got a degree in political science and a master's in cybersecurity. I work for one of the companies Chris was talking about, Verint, who writes the software that sits and monitors people for 12 years. And so obviously I'm interested in it from all aspects as far as that goes.
Let's go.
Okay, sorry, you had an audio problem.
Okay. All right, so could somebody tell me, kind of take us back to early June when the Edward Snowden revelations first came out. Can we kind of get a sense for what actually happened, what was reported, what actually transpired? Can we go back over that?
So I'll take a stab at that. In June, a whistleblower who, about a week or two after the first disclosures were made public, we learned was named Edward Snowden. He provided a bunch of documents to journalists at both The Guardian, which is a British paper that employs American journalists, and The Washington Post, a newspaper in Washington, D.C. Over the course of, well, 2 or 3 months, we've now had a series of expose after expose, almost one a week at this point. At a high level, the programs sort of fall into two categories. The first are programs aimed at non-U.S. persons, or at least programs aimed at communications where one person is in the U.S. and another person is not in the U.S., or communications where everyone is a foreigner, and then separately, domestic surveillance programs. And so the sort of two big ones that everyone may have heard a little bit about, one is called PRISM, and that's the name for the database or the tool that the NSA uses to collect communications from internet company partners, so Google, Microsoft, Facebook, some other internet companies, and the PRISM program, we're told, is focused entirely on communications where at least one party is outside the United States. The law there is, that's used to to obtain this information is something called the FISA Amendments Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendments Act. And this allows these companies to be compelled to provide access to this information. It's still not entirely clear how much of the assistance that the companies have provided was voluntary and how much of it was compelled. Since then, we've learned that about $100 million a year goes towards partnership payments. So the NSA is giving money to these companies. One telecommunications executive who was quoted in the Washington Post this week said that the payments certainly lubricate the surveillance system. So that's the PRISM program. That's aimed at stuff where there's a foreigner, but also maybe a U.S. person on the other end of the line. And then the other thing is what's known as the metadata program. And metadata, if you're not a computer geek, may not mean anything to you. At a high level, what we've learned is that for a number of years, the NSA has been collecting records of every single telephone call that takes place in the United States. Now, that's not what you're saying on the phone, but that's information about who is making the call, the numbers of the callers, when they make the call, whether it's a text message or a regular telephone call. And so they've done this both for telephone calls, and then for a number of years, they were also doing it for email. So they were collecting information about who was emailing whom, at what time, maybe a little bit of information about where the computer might have been. And the government has told us a few things about this program. They've said that this information is only being used for terrorism cases. They've told us that only about 20 people are authorized to create the search terms that are used to dig through the data. And they've told us that don't worry, we are only collecting data about who's calling whom. It's not sensitive. It's just the stuff that shows up on your phone bill. So we filed a brief in court this week. So I should note that only one court order was made public by Edward Snowden, and that was a court order compelling Verizon, one of the largest telecommunications companies in the United States, to hand over every telephone record that it had on an ongoing basis about its customers. So we had actually sued the U.S. government last year, and we ultimately lost at the Supreme Court this spring. We represented a bunch of civil rights activists and journalists who believed that they were the targets of surveillance. And we lost this case at the Supreme Court because our clients couldn't prove 100% that they'd been the targets of a secret surveillance program. It's sort of a catch-22. And so when the Verizon court order came out, we looked at it and we quickly called up our general counsel and said, hey, who does the ACLU use as its phone company? I mean, it turned out that we use Verizon.
Nice.
So we were probably the only happy Verizon customer that week.
Nice.
And so we immediately filed a lawsuit against the NSA, representing ourselves. In this case, we believe that the ACLU has been injured. We believe that people may not contact us. We think our own activities are chilled. We are having to take steps to protect our attorney-client communications and to shield information about our activities. And so I just want to emphasize sort of why this stuff is sensitive, because it may not be intuitive as to why numbers that you dial are sensitive. And so we filed a brief in court last week, sort of digging into these details. Through this database of 99% of domestic telephone call records, NSA has records of everyone who's called an abortion clinic, everyone who's called a suicide hotline, everyone who's called a battered women's shelter. They have every telephone record of anyone who's called a news organization, a whistleblower hotline to report waste or fraud or tax evasion. I mean, there are dozens of different numbers where, yes, what you say on the phone may be important, but the mere fact you're calling that number is extremely sensitive. There are companies like Verint who sell sophisticated data mining software, allowing the government to figure out patterns and relationships and social networks based on who's calling whom. If someone calls you at 2 a.m. on a Friday and you pick up, that person might be important in your life. If you call someone every evening at 2 a.m, maybe you have some kind of special relationship with them. And if you stop calling them at 2 a.m, maybe you are no longer in a relationship with them. If you never make calls on Friday evenings and Saturdays during the day, maybe you're Jewish. If you make lots of phone calls on Christmas Day, maybe you are Christian. There are many, many things about your personal life that can be determined through your telephone calls. And so we sued the NSA. We believe that this program not only violates statutory law, but violates the Fourth Amendment and violates our First Amendment right to freely communicate with others. So we filed this suit. Other groups have also filed suit. Since then, we've learned even more about the NSA program. Just a week and a half ago, we learned, although we've been told by government officials that there have been no abuses of this program. It turns out if you build a gigantic database of everyone's communications and you give it to employees who work in secret, that there are on occasion abuses. These abuses happen often enough that there's a name for when an intelligence analyst looks up information about their ex-wife or ex-husband or current girlfriend or current boyfriend, and that's called LoveInt. So SIGINT is the name for signals intelligence. LoveInt is the name for, romance intelligence. So we're told that there have been some incidents where analysts have looked into the communications of their love interests. But we're told, don't worry, these are just few and far between. And when those people have been caught, they have been punished in some way, although no one has actually gone to jail for abusing that authority. So what I want to make sure you understand is that the government is, in fact, collecting vast amounts of information about our communications. They are not targeting just people who are suspected of a crime. Their theory, which we can discuss today, is they believe that to find the needle in the haystack, you need the entire haystack, even if that means you get a lot of innocent people's communications. So I look forward to having a discussion and answering some questions with my with these spectacular panelists.
One thing, you mentioned that only 20 people have the ability to create the searches. How many have the ability to execute those searches created?
We don't know.
So I'll play devil's advocate for just a minute and ask you, you know, I'm not really doing anything wrong. Why should I worry about this? What's the real problem here?
I've got one for you there based on Target. How many of you know about the girl who didn't know or whose parents didn't know she was pregnant and Target told them about it? All right. Target is a whole division which does nothing but statistical analysis of what you buy. And all they're looking at is your buying patterns. They've got no idea why you're buying them or what you're buying them for. But as they started building this up, they started noticing certain trends. Women who are pregnant bought certain things. They bought certain combinations of things. Nothing baby-like. It'll just be like dietary supplements, certain vitamins, folic acid, for example. And as a result, they actually sent this girl a congratulations on being pregnant package and give her a whole bunch of discounts and whatnot. And turns out her dad got the mail and her dad didn't know she was pregnant. And she was like 15 or 16 at the time. So there was a huge row about that. And that's now why when you get the mailer, you now get a bulk mailer of everything because they're covering their bases on that. They're still doing the analysis, but they're doing it, they're covering themselves because they're not just sending that you're pregnant, they're sending for everything as well now.
Yeah, they found it was a little less creepy if they included the baby products with like dog food, even if they didn't think that you had a dog.
Right. So this works pretty much the same way. It's a question of who you're calling. So if you're calling a bunch of news agencies, for example, but you're not a news person, then people start wondering about you. If you start calling a bunch of folk that may be on a watch list somewhere, even if you're a completely casual friend with them, you become a target. So it's very much not what you're saying, but like Chris was saying with the metadata, it's who you're calling, when you're calling, because if you're suddenly calling some whistleblower hotline at 3 o'clock in the morning on a regular basis, someone's going to start asking questions why.
And this idea that, well, look, if I have nothing to hide, why should I worry? I mean, that's a bit selfish. Like, you know, I am a white male I make enough money to pay my rent. That doesn't mean I shouldn't worry about racism or inequality. And there are people who have things that they need to hide. There are people who called abuse hotlines. There are people who need the services of battered women's shelters, and we should protect their privacy. There are people in this country for whom that information existing and falling into the wrong hands, it would be a life or death matter, and we shouldn't just roll over and let the government get everyone's communications just because we live in a comfortable life and have nothing to worry about. And you know, the fact is that people do have things that that they, you know, they don't want their spouses or their colleagues or their neighbors to know about. We have curtains in our homes. We wear clothes. Some of us wear clothes when we walk down the street. You know, you don't broadcast the list of prescription medication you use. It's not sitting on the dining table in your house, but it's usually in your medicine cabinet, and people are not supposed to look through it, although everyone does seem to. Look, there are secrets. And okay, so let's say you acknowledge that there are things that you want to be private, but you trust the government. You genuinely trust the government, and that's fine. You know, many people might. Well, the data's there, and it's going to be there for a while. You may trust this government, but that doesn't mean that you should trust the government that we're going to get down the road. You know, the NSA is like a digital pack rat. They are storing this data, and they're never going to want to get rid of it. And the government we get in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years may be very different and may have a very different perspective on your pet issue. If you really believe in gun rights, the next government might not share your view. If you really believe in freedom of religion, the next government might not share your view. And so I think you should be worried. Even if the current government is 100% on your side, that this data could be built up and used against you at some point down the road.
And that's really the issue. Even if there's no problem now, you don't have anything to hide now or anything to worry about now. Or why should I be concerned? Because I'm not a terrorist. They're only using this for terrorists. So as long as I don't do any terrorism, it won't matter. Well, once they start using the information in courts, once this information becomes admissible in something, courts are going to be willing to look at it, and it's going to be admissible in another thing, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing. And sooner or later, I'm going to be able to get it in any case I want, because it's something that courts see regularly enough that it's just another piece of evidence, and it's something that's perfectly acceptable. So
what happens when every divorce lawyer in the country says, oh, well, there's a database of every phone call. I'd like to see that, too.
I'd sure like to see it. Right, exactly. And that's what's going to happen. Or, you know, even if it's not the courts, it's the government. You say, okay, well, this is for the war on terror, and we're only going to use it to fight terrorism. But you know what? Drugs fund terrorism, so let's use this for the war on drugs. Oh, and you know what else funds terrorism? Let's use it for, you know, and they're just going to expand out what the definition is to where we can use this, to where it becomes effective, to the point where I'm going to be able to use it in a business contract case. And that's when it becomes a problem.
Or maybe you look at, say, the current no-fly list, and you start cross-correlating with this database everybody those people called frequently, and you start adding them to the no-fly list. You go, well, it's justified because these guys talk to each other all the time.
So 5 years ago, the people on this panel saying this kind of stuff would have been crazy, right? If we weren't wearing tinfoil hats, you would have imagined us wearing them. But after June, we're no longer crazy. We were just a little bit ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
I think we're
pioneers.
Years ago, it wasn't that we thought you were crazy. It's everybody thought we were all crazy. I mean, I've worked for the telephone company. I have looked up phone numbers and such because I was running tests on software.
You sure it wasn't Levant?
What?
You sure it wasn't Levant?
No, it was not Love Intelligence. Unless you want to call my grandmother.
You don't love your grandmother?
It's famine.
Oh.
It's famine. Family intelligence.
You know, I mean, like you're saying, and the thing is, 5-10 years ago, we didn't care about this stuff. By the way, it was a private college phone system is what it was, not previous employers I have worked for. But I know more about 4ESS and 5ESS than I care to say. Capacitors are great things. The thing is, we know about this stuff. We've known about this stuff for years. It's just now, today, 10 years later, 10 years ago, I ran a check on my grandmother's phone number. I got a list of phone numbers back that just, I happened to know, oh, that's Aunt Sally, that's Aunt Nancy, you know, that's the restaurant Granny goes to all the time. You know, I just happened to know those because I knew those phone numbers. But if I gave it to you, you wouldn't know who the heck these people were. But now we can go and look and say, oh, that's Sally's phone number. Sally then also called Andy. And Ann talked to, you know, and we can build this big database and find out, you know, who's building who and who's talking to who. And then And that's where it gets scary.
So what he's talking about is a technique that the government uses called call chaining. So when they're interested in researching someone, they don't just look for who that person's called, but they look for every person that they've called, and then they go out three hops or three layers. So it's not that you are engaging in a crime. It's the NSA is interested in you if you've called anyone who's called anyone who's called someone who is a suspect in an investigation. And those numbers get really, really large as you go more than two hops out.
Yeah, well, it's been referred to as a national relationship database. Basically, they have a record now that they keep for, I think they keep all the record, the phone records for 30 days or something like that because of just the volume. But now they have a record of every person that every other person has called. So they know, like you were mentioning earlier, who's important to you. And that kind of stuff becomes important even if you are not doing anything wrong. In reality, people get falsely accused of crimes all of the time. And one of the ways in which they build cases against people is by looking at who are you connected to, who do you have relationships with, who are you talking to. And they make guesses about the content, and the actual words that were said are far less important than who you called and when. So even if you haven't done anything wrong, it can be used against you very easily.
It's like a criminal version of LinkedIn. You have four connections. Yeah. You have two second connections.
Well, you figure, you know, we're all 6 degrees away from Kevin Bacon. How
now
far
we're three.
Terrorists?
Three.
Yeah.
Okay. Six from Kevin, three from terrorists.
Okay, to the audience, do you mind if we hold questions to the end? Because I want to move on. I wanted to ask about the FISA court and how the FISA court plays a role in this. I'm hearing that the FISA court is kind of a secret court. Its proceedings are not open to the public. And I'm hearing that, you know, for some recent period, they approved all but two of the wiretapping requests that they received. So it sounds like less of a due process kind of situation and more of maybe a rubber stamp kind of court. So what do we know about the FISA court? Can we talk about that and how that plays into this domestic surveillance process?
Sure. So just so everyone understands the basics, after the Watergate scandal in the 70s with Nixon, Congress and there were disclosures about massive abuses of surveillance powers by the FBI and the NSA, Congress created something called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a legal regime that regulates foreign surveillance. So this is not supposed to be the police looking into your affairs because they think you're a murderer. This is about spying.
It's supposed to be limitations on the president's power to monitor and record the activities of domestic activists. That's what FISA was intended to. That's why Kennedy introduced the act and why it was passed.
So
the thing is, it isn't just started in Kennedy. Roosevelt had tapping.
Well, hang on. That's not the legal regime. So that's other presidents engaging in surveillance. So FISA created something called the FISA court, and it's a court in Washington, D.C. The judges are all appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So they are already judges, but they are elevated to the FISA court by the Chief Judge. They fly into Washington, D.C., and they're on duty for 1 week at a time. Until about 5 years ago, they were actually, the FISA courtroom was located in the Department of Justice, and they realized that didn't look so great for independence reasons. So they actually finally have a room behind a locked door on the third floor of the federal courthouse in D.C. Just, I think, a month ago, a couple activists tried to find the FISA court. Turns out, you know, you can't just walk into the courtroom, but they walked up to the third floor of the main D.C. federal court and found an unmarked door with a fingerprint scanner and a few other security devices outside and realized what it was. You're not allowed to take cameras into the federal courthouse. They drew a photo, or they had an artist draw it. And so that the drawing of the FISA court door is now online. That's about the closest any of us have gotten to see it. The FISA court only has one podium, and what I mean is that there aren't two sides who argue before the FISA court. Just the government gets to go and argue there, they have a track record of almost always approving the orders for surveillance that they get. I think in the last 4 years, they've said no just once. Now, if the surveillance happens outside the United States, the government doesn't even need to go to the FISA court. So if the government taps an undersea cable or performs surveillance out of a U.S. embassy in Paris, they don't need to go to the FISA court. That stuff is all okay. But so the FISA court meets in secret. Only the government gets to argue before them. And then, for the most part, all of their opinions are kept sealed. And over the last few years, they've secretly reinterpreted key portions of legal statutes, including the word relevance in a domestic surveillance statute. So the government is only supposed to be able to get information that is relevant to an investigation, and they have interpreted the word relevant to mean everyone's communications in matters of terrorism. And so that's how they've been able to get everyone's domestic telephone records through this section of the Patriot Act.
Aren't they also one of the only ones who do retroactive authorization? So they'll come and say, we found something, now we need you to authorize, say, we could have gone back in time and recorded this.
Yeah, in general, criminal prosecutions, you have to have, the search wouldn't be valid if you didn't have a warrant at the time that the search was executed. And FISA is one of the, as far as I know, the only way in which they could, after the fact, go, whoops, yep, I had probable cause to seize that or search that phone or whatever. And I think that they do have a limited time frame, but yep, they can do it retroactively.
So depending on your views, I mean, normally we would want the court to be somewhat well-balanced. We would want a variety of opinions on the court, but when a single Chief Justice gets to pick every judge that is on the FISA court, and none of their opinions are ever public, or I think we've only had a couple, and that's been through special circumstances, yeah. You might get a certain perspective that dominates the court. I mean, the identities of the judges are public. They're available online. They're all regular federal judges, right? So they just get elevated to the court by Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts. But you know, we just got a major FISA opinion unclassified and published about a week and a half ago, and in that one we found out that NSA had charitably misled the court for 3 years about the scale of its surveillance. So even assuming the FISA court is doing a good job, they're not capable of doing what they're supposed to do because the NSA is pulling the wool over their eyes. So the entire system shouldn't give you much cause for comfort.
Just to make sure we have a little bit of balance, I mean, this isn't going to make it better, but to make things clear, there is only one side arguing to get a warrant in the FISA court. But in fairness, if you go to a regular criminal proceeding and you go and seek a warrant, the state's the only one arguing to get a warrant against you for any other criminal investigation, too, because as a practical matter, you don't know that you need to go hire a lawyer and send your side in to talk about it because they haven't arrested you yet. They're trying to get that evidence.
But eventually,
so getting that warrant is there. But again, that doesn't make it better, and it doesn't make it doesn't make it okay that this is a private proceeding that happens completely behind security locked doors, because at least a warrant is sworn out in a regular, you know, magistrate or superior court courtroom in open court for every other criminal activity. There might not ever be anybody in it, but it is at least an open court that someone could be in if they wanted to.
And probably a lot more failure rate too, not necessarily like rubber stamping just about everything.
Sure.
And it eventually is handed over to the affidavit, the foundation for probable, or the basis for probable cause in a standard criminal prosecution is eventually handed over to the defense,
right,
so that when and if a trial happens, that people can, the defense attorneys can argue that such and such piece of evidence should be excluded because there was a probable cause, or at least challenge that. With what's happening with the FISA courts is that information's never turned over, so it can never be challenged by anyone at any point.
And in fact, we learned through a story by Reuters a couple of weeks ago that the NSA has been sharing information with the DEA, the drug enforcement folks, using a technique that they call parallel construction. So the NSA will basically tell the DEA guys, you may want to go to that parking lot, you know, 5th and Main Street at 2 in the morning and see what happens. Oh, and bring a drug dog. And we won't tell you why. And then, of course, two cars show up and they, you know, bring the dog and they find something. And then their DEA is instructed to find another reason to have brought the dogs there so as to keep the true source of the intelligence out of the case. And so this is something that the term, or this technique happens often enough that it's been given the term parallel construction. This is deeply, deeply troubling. It's one thing when the intelligence information is used for intelligence matters, but it's another when it is used for regular law enforcement cases.
Okay.
Scary?
So you're saying to avoid some type of Boston Marathon type of activity, it's good, but to avoid our kids getting drugs, not so much.
Well, for that realm, yes, because you're talking in two completely different legal realms here. Technically, if you really want to go that route, you could go the whole Microsoft Xbox One route. I don't know how many of you have been following that, where Microsoft was releasing things where they're going to be monitoring the Xbox stuff with things like targeted ads, making sure DRM compliant. So if you've bought a family for your, a movie for your family, but you've got like a whole party there, they'd be like, yeah, there's too many people in the room. You can't watch this. It's not correctly licensed. That would tie in so easily to something like a surveillance program, because Microsoft's got the data. Mm-hmm. All the NSA's got to do is go tell the courts, tell Microsoft they have to give us this data, and they can't tell anyone they're giving us this data. And now the NSA's got a direct audio and video feed into every room in the country that has an Xbox One. So at that point, then, it's like, all right, where do we sort of draw the line? Is it okay if we tell you that your kid's playing hooky or that your kid's planning on, you know, going and buying pot for the first time? Yeah, it's great when you've got a clear-cut thing like, yeah, we have evidence and we have video of these guys plotting to go blow up something. That's great and fine. But at what point do you draw the line where it's like it's no longer terrorism, but it's a crime, and then a crime versus a misdemeanor or a misdemeanor versus a parenting issue? And the lines can get very blurry because every parent wants to stop their kids from doing drugs, and certainly doing pot's not at the level of, you know, blowing up a building, but the data's there. Who gets access under what conditions becomes the question.
And I think that the question of, you know, it's almost a misleading question because it presumes that this information is okay. And it is okay to gather all this data as long as we're preventing terrorism. And I don't know that I would draw that line. The reality is that, is this okay for terrorism but not for drugs, is a meaningless line. Because if it's okay for one, why not for the other? And if it's not okay for one, then why not for the other?
And we should note that all of the collection that NSA was engaged in didn't actually stop the Boston attacks. We have the bad side, with we have all the surveillance, and then we don't actually stop the attacks. You know, the other sort of response to your question is that in the reason we have different rules for intelligence and criminal surveillance is that in the criminal context, the government puts you in jail, right? And you want to make sure that the government is following the rules when they are taking away your liberty. In the intelligence context, they don't really generally use that information to prosecute people. There are prosecutions where FISA information is introduced, but they're very, very rare. For the most part, the intelligence stuff is used to stop terrorist attacks or to find foreign spies, you know, who are engaging in espionage. When we find a spy, we usually just kick them out. It's very rare that they get prosecuted. So I think, you know, we have a different set of rules for criminal surveillance. We have a different set of rules for intelligence surveillance. And in the criminal context, if the police are going to put you in jail for 20 years, you want to make sure that they protected your rights. You want to make sure that they followed the Fourth Amendment, that they didn't engage in warrantless surveillance, that they followed all of the rules that our founders put there to stop police abuses. And you might be comfortable with a more flexible set of rules when it comes to stopping terrorist attacks, when they are not going to use that information to put Americans behind bars.
First thing, you mentioned trying to find a needle in a haystack. The surveillance that they're doing, they're trying to find a needle in a stack of needles, not a haystack, which makes it a lot more complex. That's the first thing. Second thing, you've been going back and forth to that, well, what we're calling reasoning, the fallacy of the slippery slope, which, yeah, it's possible, but in reasoning, that's not necessarily correct or accurate. But you keep on going to, well, if they have this data, they may do this, that, and the other thing. Yes, they may, but they may not. We don't have any proof.
We do. I worked for a company that did that. It absolutely happens.
I'm not saying that it doesn't. I say that in reasoning, that's a fallacy.
Well,
now, on top of that, the third thing I want to point out is right now I don't see a better system that we can use in order to stop terror attacks, and I don't see anyone coming up with a better solution than the surveillance gets being done, especially the metadata part of it, which can be aggregated.
Why don't you talk to us after the panel, sir?
Let me just actually respond to that real quick, because there probably is no better way. So the question that you have to, well, the question there was a lot of questions. What I'm responding to was the statement that there's no better way to prevent terrorism, and so what do we do? What do we do if not this? And the answer is, I don't know. There probably is no better way. But what you have to ask yourself is, are you willing to compromise this element of your liberty to get the security that provides?
Possible security.
The possible security, right. And look, it's probably effective. It wasn't effective in Boston. It's probably been effective 100 other times we don't know about. It's probably done great things. But the question is, Is it worth it? And that's, I think, everybody makes their own judgment on that, and everybody's going to make their own decision, and everybody in this room would have a different answer, probably a very different answer than me. But that is the core question that goes to the element of, is this a good thing? Is this something that we're willing to compromise this element of our liberty, and we're willing to allow the government to get this data to protect us from this unknown? And that's, you got to make up your own mind about that.
Okay. I want to switch things around here and kind of move on to the next question. As far as questions, I do want to take audience questions, but I want to ask if you could possibly line up in this aisle here. And we'll take questions toward the end. And if you have a disability or a way that for some reason you can't come out and line up here, then I'll come out to you, but it would be best for us if you could just line up here, and then we'll take it all in a line. But the next thing I wanted to ask is really, we've been assured by the government over and over again that these programs are legal, but no one has the guts to say that they're constitutional. Can we talk about some of the enabling laws, like the Patriot Act and things like that? What sort of framework is the government putting into place to kind of claim this is legal? Because I get the sense that the surveillance came first and then the laws came second to try to fix the problem.
Well, we're not real sure about the constitutionality of the FISA regs. That's still sort of up in the air. And in fact, it's being challenged. It's being challenged by you guys, isn't it?
It's difficult to challenge FISA, right? Because it's secret.
But the Patriot Act is a Patriot Act. We all let that go through, and now it's perfectly constitutional because there's a law that says we can do it.
Well, so we haven't had the opportunity to challenge it before. There's sort of two big speed bumps in the way of us challenging it. The first is something called standing, which is a legal regime where you have to prove that you have been harmed in some way to be able to bring a challenge, and it's really difficult in the surveillance context because you have to prove that you've been monitored with a secret program before you have authority or have a ability to challenge that program. So the only way you can really do it is if the government screws up. And there have been instances where the government has screwed up. The most famous one is a case called Al Haramain, which was a Muslim charity from Oregon that was spied on by the government. And in the course of a criminal case, the government accidentally handed over secret illegal intercepts to the charity, intercepts of the charity's calls to the charity. And they realized quickly that they'd done it and said, oops, can we have those back? And so the charity sued, and when that happened, then the second speed bump, or brick wall, rather, came in, which is called the state secrets doctrine, which is something that this administration and the Bush administration before it were both big fans of. And it's generally this idea that the government can come into court and say, this issue is so important that even discussing it in court is a threat to national security, and therefore the entire case should be thrown out. And so we've lost a number of cases related to torture and surveillance on state secrets grounds. You know, our view is if this program is constitutional, well, let us have our day in court, let us argue it, and we think we'll win. But we have been denied that opportunity several times. We're looking forward to the lawsuit we've just recently filed. We think that we have a really good shot, at least on the standing issue. As for state secrets, you know, the government can always come in and lay down that trump card. But, in terms of the legality of this program, starting in about 2009, several senators, including Ron Wyden and Senator Udall from Colorado, said that there had been secret reinterpretations of the Patriot Act, that if the American public learned what they were, they would be shocked at how vast the surveillance was. And those senators hinted repeatedly from the floor of the Senate. They wrote New York Times op-eds, again saying that there was a secret program that reinterpreted, that depended on a reinterpretation of the statute. And so it doesn't just matter what the laws say in writing. It also matters right. how they've been interpreted
right.
by the Department of Justice. And in this case, the interpretation of the law was kept secret by DOJ. The program was kept secret, and we didn't learn about it until Edward Snowden took that brave step of leaking those documents. And without him, we wouldn't know what's going on. We wouldn't be having this debate. We wouldn't be having this panel at this conference were it not for Edward Snowden. So I think we all owe him a thank you.
How many of you think you have a constitutional right to privacy? Which amendment is it in? No, it's actually interpretation of about four or five different ones. It's not actually stated, and I suspect that's where a lot of this is going to come down to. It's for a long time people have said we want a constitutional amendment that says we have the right to privacy. Because once you get that, it becomes a lot harder to reinterpret it. Right now, it's heading towards a situation where the courts can go, well, you've had a interpreted right of privacy, but it was never actually codified. Therefore, we can interpret it to a much lower standard, which benefits us, but not you.
So what he's describing is this loophole in the Fourth Amendment created by the Supreme Court called the Third Party Doctrine. And the gist of this is that if you give your private information to a third party, like a bank or a phone company or an internet company like Google, the government believes that they can get that information without a warrant. And it's very difficult these days to conduct your modern life and engage in any form of commerce or communication without relying on an internet company or a phone company to handle the communication along the way. And so the government has relied on this regime to justify its massive collection of all Americans' telephone communications.
Right. They just the argument is that it is not an unreasonable search or seizure of that information because you've already disclosed it to somebody, whether it's for so AT&T can bill you or so that your internet service provider knows who you need to send that email to. You've already disclosed that, so you have no reasonable expectation of privacy anymore, and that's the cornerstone of Fourth Amendment. So the argument is that most of the stuff that they're collecting lies outside of the Fourth Amendment, and that's only, you have to remember that the only time the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution really comes into play with this is whenever you're dealing with somebody who's a U.S. citizen. The
Or permanent resident.
Right. The Constitution gives the president vast amounts of leeway in securing our national borders. And so the Fourth Amendment isn't going to apply to anything that happens outside, or I should phrase it this way, it's not going to apply to a lot of what FISA does because those people are outside of the United States and would not be covered by Fourth Amendment. So, and I think that that's a lot of why we feel like this is very offensive to us because we think of our Fourth Amendment rights, but some of this just, Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to some of them.
The government believes that most of our communications are transmitted in a Fourth Amendment-free zone. We disagree with that, and Justice Sotomayor of the Supreme Court wrote a concurring opinion in an important case called USB Jones, which is about GPS tracking. So when the government puts a right. secret GPS device under your car, she wrote in her concurring opinion 2 years ago that maybe it's time to reexamine the third party doctrine. And we agree with her. We think that it's, you know, that system in the law comes from a series of cases. It was basically like the government wanted to find out the numbers you dialed.
And
they said, you know, this is information that's printed on your phone bill. Of course, you know that the phone company gets it. That was, you know, 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago. Times have changed, and people deserve privacy protections for these things. There's no way to send an email without an internet company, unless you're, like, hand-delivering the message, and then it's not email anymore. Even carrier pigeon involves a third party. It involves the pigeon. so we think that it's time, you know, we're not waiting for the courts to get around to doing this either. We are actively working, our lobbyists in Washington are working with members of Congress to reform our electronic communications privacy laws. The law that governs When the Government Can Get Your Information, it was written in 1986, which was before Google, before Facebook, before Twitter, before, well, if you had a cell phone, it was this big. And so there are proposals on the table right now that congressional committees are considering that would require a warrant signed by a judge for the government to get your email. At the state level, states are considering this. Texas is the first state in the country to require a warrant for emails. That just happened a couple months ago. And so we hope that while the courts figure out what they're doing, legislatures at the state and federal level are going to kick into gear and provide strong protections for our digital communications.
The problem with something like that, though, is so Texas passes this law. Does that mean your ISP has to be in Texas and you have to be in Texas and only emailing Texas people?
You know, that there's a lack of clarity in the law. I hope that it is interpreted that if you use an ISP in Texas, that suddenly you get the protection of this law. Suddenly, that'll make internet companies in Texas very happy. Of course, that law doesn't apply to the feds. That only applies to state law enforcement agencies. State legislatures have no authority to decide what the federal law enforcement agencies can do, which is why the DEA keeps busting pot clinics in California.
Here's the thing, though. You've got to realize that what we're talking about is how the government can collect your data and use it against you. You all have to take some steps of your own. If you want to have some privacy, take some damn steps to make sure that you've got some privacy. The reality is that it amazes me every year I come here that people get wrapped up on some big issue. This year it's the NSA, and this is a big issue, and we need to be here discussing this. But you're all worried that the NSA might be looking at your email, but you all probably have a Gmail account, and you all probably have Facebook, and you all probably have, you know, the NSA has some information about your email transmission data. Google said they're reading your fucking emails, but nobody cares about that because I like Gmail and it's free. I don't like the NSA, so I'm going to complain. You can't give away your privacy. You can't give a third party click-through permission to read whatever they want, use whatever they want. At least the NSA isn't selling your data to an advertiser. Yet, you know, yes.
Yeah. Wait till sequester happens.
But you're concerned about your privacy and how the government's going to use it, but yet you're giving it away. You're just allowing people to read your information. You can't do that.
Scott, you need some questions?
Some of us would probably believe that it's reasonable for the government to collect data, data for anti-terrorism or even other purposes, as long as it's particular, it's reasonable in scale. But when it's their scale matters, and when it's over everyone all the time, that's totally different. So scale is a big thing. What I have not heard at all is what's happened with scale. We've been in the war on terror for 12 years or so now. We hear all of these kinds of data collection, but we don't hear what the volume of data collection has been over time. Administrations change. They change their priorities. I happen to particularly distrust the Obama administration. They've used the Department of Justice in unusual ways. They've used the IRS in unusual ways. They've picked out things for political purposes. I don't know that they picked out any of this for political purposes. I certainly think that they're capable of it. I haven't heard anything at all about the scale of data collection and scale of data usage over time and what's happened. I'm amazed that I haven't heard that. Do any of you know anything about that, about the scale of what's been collected?
I would assume everything.
Over time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would assume everything. The problem is less what it is, not if they can get the data, but what they can do with it.
No, I actually mean what's happened over that time period, the data collection pre 2009 versus post 2009.
Well, that's sort of the problem, is that we don't know what they're doing. I mean, all kind of suspect what they're doing, but until these disclosures came out, you didn't know for sure this was occurring, and that they were getting this data, and that they were getting this type of electronic data, or that they had the split fiber optics and were running your data through their own. Until you know these things are occurring, you don't know they're occurring, and so it's impossible really to go back and say, unless the government opens up its vaults and shows us what's been going on from 2001 to 2013 and whether it's gotten bigger, smaller, or stayed the same. Because we really don't have enough data about what they're doing right now.
But the reason I assume everything is because of how technology is evolving. Our lines are getting faster, data centers are getting bigger and quicker. It becomes easier to store larger amounts of information. Now, what they can do with that information is a whole different ball of wax, because then you start getting into how fast can your computers process the information you have, how much can they glean from what they have, and how quickly can they do it. That becomes more of a scalability issue just in the tech side, but even that's changing really, really fast. But as far as simple collection goes, that's really just a question of hard drive space.
And so there's a long line of people behind you, so you should probably pass the mic.
Thank you. Just expounding on the point TJ was making earlier, for some of us that aren't as technically savvy, like what can we do in our everyday lives to kind of make it harder to have our communications tracked without completely going off the grid or disengaging completely and, you know, moving into a bunker?
Buy a hoodie, get some sunglasses.
Yeah. So look, abstinence-based education, sex education doesn't work. So let's give practical advice here. I'm not telling you to go and live in a cave, because you're not going to do that. You want to enjoy a modern digital life. And so telling you to just stop using email is silly, because you will use email. The best thing you can do is to sort of be a little bit smart. And so as a general rule of thumb, the telephone companies are far more likely to go out of their way to help the government than internet companies, as a general rule of thumb. Google provides public reports about how many requests they get from law enforcement agencies every year. They're fighting. Google and Microsoft are currently fighting at the FISA court to be able to provide statistics about how many intelligence requests they get. You know, when all of this stuff came out, all the Snowden revelations came out, the internet companies said, wait. We weren't providing that much information. You know, we're only providing data on a targeted basis. All of the big allegations about domestic surveillance were about the telephone companies. The phone companies haven't in any way disputed the facts. They've said, we get requests, we comply, but we can't tell you anything more. Anything you can do to keep your private information out of the hands of a phone company and instead shift it to an internet company is probably gonna keep your data at least out of the wholesale dragnet surveillance databases. If the government really wants you, they're gonna get you. We learned just a few weeks ago that the FBI now has a team of people who do nothing but hack into phones and computers, enabling webcams and microphones and stealing documents from computers. If you are an actual target, they're gonna get what they want from your device, but you can make it more difficult. And you can make dragnet surveillance, where they just search for terms. You know, everyone who's put the following word in their email. If you shift your communications away from phone companies and to internet companies, if you switch from a telephone to Skype or Google Hangout or FaceTime, even Skype makes Skype. So there were reports in the Post saying that Skype had been providing information to the NSA. Again, Microsoft insists that they only do that on a targeted basis, whereas the telephone companies are providing everything wholesale. So if you never want the NSA to get your information, that's a really high bar to cross. But if you just want to make it more difficult and you don't want them to turn up your data when they're doing keyword searches, I would do everything possible to migrate my data to the internet companies. And as a general rule of thumb, to sort of address the point that he made, you should try and use services the way you pay for it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the dominant business model in Silicon Valley is users give their data, companies mine the data, analyze it for ads, and then show ads or let other companies show ads. If you want companies to be able to protect your data from the government, you have to give them a way to make money and not look at your data. And that means you need to write them a check. And I'm not saying that email needs to cost $1 million or $1,000, but even paying $20 a year for your online backup service or your email service will allow that company to make money while protecting your privacy. Otherwise, you put them in a really difficult situation where they have to either extract your data and hang on to it for a long period of time or not return any profit to their shareholders. And Silicon Valley engineers are expensive. They, you know, it's not cheap living in San Jose or in San Francisco. So you need to pay for the services you use. That's the cold hard truth.
And once you're there, be very selective about who you're using. Actually read those click through things and realize what you're giving away before you click it. And you know, try to use proxies, try to use other maxing.
So telling people to read their terms of service is a little bit like telling people to live in a cave.
Yeah.
No one's going to do that.
What is. I tell my clients to read contract all the time. Nobody does.
My question is regarding the lawsuit that was mentioned earlier. Let's say you win and it's judged to be illegal to gather your information. Since you're an organization, how will that judgment benefit individuals, since they could be deemed completely separate categories legally?
So we've asked them to stop the program, not just for us, but we've asked them to stop the domestic metadata collection program. We just have the ability to sue because we are an injured party. And we are not the only ones who've sued. An organization called the Other EFF, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, they have sued representing some churches and gun rights groups and journalists. There are multiple lawsuits underway. And if the courts don't work as an avenue, there are also, congressional investigations right now. There was a very, very narrowly lost vote in the House just a few weeks back to defund the domestic metadata collection program. If you haven't called your member of Congress, you might want to think about letting them know what you think about the program. I'm not telling you which way to call, but if you have strong feelings about this, you may want to let your member know. I'm hopeful, but we do lose a lot in the surveillance litigation area. It's an uphill battle, and the government has some really powerful litigation weapons that I wish we had.
So you're hoping to start like a snowball effect or something, like maybe one thing would cause another to happen? And
well, we're hoping to win our lawsuit. But if we don't win our lawsuit, hopefully someone else will win their lawsuit. And if that doesn't work, hopefully we'll get changed through Congress. And if that doesn't work, hopefully the internet companies will start fighting for their customers a bit more. But we only have to win in one way.
Right. And the answer is yes. I mean, it is a snowball. Once you get one victory, I can take that victory to another court and say there's already been a victory. And so it should apply here and apply here, apply here. And, you know, it is something that would snowball, but that first win is the key.
But ultimately it comes down to the voters, because we're the ones who put these people into Congress in the first place. All of this we're talking about is controlled by 535 people. The U.S. voting population is the one who decides which 535 people get to go make these decisions. So if we're not going to do it from a voting level, there's no reason for them to do it from their level, because they're looking after their interests first. The only elected official in this country who cares what the entire country thinks is the president. Everyone else only cares about their voters, because they're the ones that they have to answer to. So every senator, every congressional representative only cares about the one who can actually vote them into office. So while you've got senatorial committees and congressional committees and everything else, if your representative isn't on one of those committees, they don't really care about your voice, because you're not voting for any of them. So you have to make sure that your representatives know who you are, where you stand, and that, you know, how you feel about things on an individual basis, because that's what they're going to pay attention to, because that's how they stay where they are.
But just if you do call your member, be very polite on the phone. Person who's answering the phone is usually an unpaid intern. They're like 19 years old. Be nice to them.
Don't make them cry.
Okay, we need to move on.
Well, getting back to the idea about can we actually do something about this, I've got an idea I want to run it by you guys, but since we're Dragon Con, let's do a little bit of quick role-playing. Mr. TJ, since you're a lawyer, sir, I have a dollar here. I'd like to give this to you. Will you be my lawyer?
I've now been retained.
So you've been retained. Now, if I give you my email address and you give me yours, in theory, we're having a private, attorney-client privilege communications, right? Mm-hmm. So now, if you were to win the lottery tomorrow and decide to form the next great email service, could everybody here in this room do the same thing?
Well, here's the thing. How are you emailing me? Because your email is attorney-client privileged to the extent that when he sues you, mm-hmm. and I'm your attorney, I can't give your email to him. They don't care. And if that's your email service out there, they're all reading our email. And they all know what you say to me and what I said back, because you've clicked a little button that says you can read my email. And that's not an attorney-client violation. The attorney-client privilege keeps me from being able to reveal the information to someone who is opposed to you in a legal sense. So, it'd be nice if it worked that way, but the reality is, If you email me from a Gmail account or a Yahoo account, I hate to pick on Gmail, just they came out in the news, it's going to be something that someone somewhere probably knows what you've said to me, or could if they wanted to.
But you should keep the dollar.
A lawyer never gives a dollar back.
But as a systems engineer who's done a little bit of work with this sort of stuff in terms of, you know, how they actually do the mechanics of getting access to that email.
Yeah, but we won't do that now.
What's that?
I said we won't be able to get to that now. We'll need to.
Oh, okay.
If you're hanging around afterwards, we can talk
about
it. That's
a long line.
Yeah. All right.
This is the last question.
Yeah, this question is really designed to mess you guys up. So, the first question.
You did lose a dollar.
Well, you left one. I have no money to give you. Quick show of hands. How many of you on the panel know the name Ralph Schrader?
Sure. I saw a record, Ralph.
Okay. That's the best answer.
Now,
so
Schrader.
Okay. How many of you know the NICE symbol BAH? Okay, B-A-H. Okay, Booz Allen Hamilton.
Okay.
Okay, Ralph Schrader is the CEO of Booz Allen Hamilton. So you have any idea how much money Booz Allen Hamilton gave to what Congress people in the last election cycle?
They'll be giving to everyone who can benefit them.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I, you said something I take a little bit of an issue with. You say, oh, us voters, it's who we voted. No, it's not. It's who Booz Allen Hamilton pays.
But you still vote for those people.
I can vote for one guy who boos Alan Hamilton, or I can pay for the other guy who boos Alan Hamilton is paid.
Don't vote for either one.
There are members of Congress who believe that these surveillance programs are illegal and are willing to vote that way regardless of who gives the money. Look, politicians generally are receptive to donations when they are about issues that their constituents don't care about.
Mm-hmm.
Most politicians get voted in on one or two important issues, and they know their constituents care about those couple issues, and then the other ones, those are the ones where the money may help to grease the wheels a little bit.
Okay.
Surveillance is becoming an issue that constituents care about and are calling about, and when you make this a high-profile issue, when a member gets thousands of phone calls about this issue, suddenly they need to think about how they vote. When it's an obscure issue and the vote is happening and no articles get written and they get no phone calls, then they feel more comfortable to make votes that are where their friends are on the same side as them, they're moneyed friends. So the best thing you can do is to let your member know that this is an issue that you care about. It doesn't even really matter which way you believe, as long as they know it's an issue that's important, suddenly it's an issue that matters, and then the donations don't matter nearly as much.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to have to cut it here. We do have another panel tomorrow on CISPA and FBI wiretapping, and it's a lot of the same panelists. So that will be tomorrow. Thank you. 201.